franchise me, or he said, no. Thanks. Well, I'm pretty much going to just stand up here and talk. So I don't think it'll be too complicated. Well, it's traditional. Large chunks of it come out of Psalm 92. It's attributed to King Alfred himself. However, the contemporary versification of it comes from a Texan by the name of Kemper Crabb, C-R-A-B-B. It's Psalm 91, Psalm 92, bits and pieces from several places. Well, good afternoon. I trust that you are thoroughly, thoroughly exhausted at this point. And we're not going to do anything too terribly rigorous during this quick one-hour workshop. I do want it to be practical for you, so I'm going to introduce some ideas for you, and then what we're going to do is we'll talk about them a little bit and talk about the practical implications and the implementation of the ideas. First, I want to do a little bit of a commercial plug. I hope that you have taken the opportunity to spend a lot of time walking through the exhibits downstairs and poring over the book tables and being thoroughly tempted to violate every rule and propriety when it comes to budgets. There are all kinds of wonderful resources down there, and some of those resources, you need to know, are the results of blood, toil, tears, and sweat from those who have been in the trenches before you. And so I commend to you those resources downstairs. There are a few of the tables that are actually giving away things. One of those is the Classical School of the Medes booth, which is a wonderful mission, and we actually have some of the pioneers of the Classical School of the Medes right here in this room with us. The Classical School of the Medes is an astonishing work in northern Iraq, where God has raised up classical Christian schools utilizing an unabashedly Christian worldview curriculum to begin to reshape the hearts and the minds and the souls and the consciences and the cultural awareness of a whole new generation of Iraqis. If you don't know anything about the Classical School of the Medes, you need to hasten down, beat a path to that booth. They're also giving away a CD that has a series of lectures that I gave on the history of Iraq, along with the executive director of Servant Group International, which is the missions organization that has overseen the classical school of the Medes, Dave Dillard. And the two of us, about a year ago, did a series of lectures, and there are PowerPoints and all of that, to give sort of the surprising history of the land of Iraq. If you don't know the history, you need to. Anyway, they're giving away those lectures. So there are two good reasons to go by that booth. And then make sure you just linger long at the Canon Press table and the Standfast Books table and all of the others, and just bust the budget. So much for commercial endorsements. Let me introduce the subject of our workshop. It is a theology of wonder, integrating the humanities in the life of your school and your curriculum. I want to start with a historical vignette, one of which you are, I trust, very familiar. It was June the 6th, 1774, following the convening of the First Continental Congress, the Revolutionary Convention of the House of Burgesses met in Richmond, Virginia, in the St. John's Parish Church. It was there that, after a series of discussions about the conflict between the mother country, Great Britain, and the colonial possessions scattered up and down the Atlantic coast, Patrick Henry rose and gave a sterling address, the words of which are still familiar and ring true to us to this day. They tell us, sir, that we are weak, unable to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will we be in the next week or the next year? When will it be? When we are totally disarmed? And when a guard shall be stationed at every house? Shall we gather strength by irresolution and inaction? Shall we acquire the means of effectual resistance by laying supinely upon our backs and hugging the delusive phantom of hope until our enemies shall have bound us hand and foot? Surely, sir, we are not weak if we make a proper use of the means by which the God of nature hath placed in our power. Our people, armed in the holy cause of liberty, in such a country which we possess, are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of men and nations, who will raise friends to fight our battles for us and with us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, to the active, to the brave. There is no retreat but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged, and their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable, so let it come. I repeat, sir, let it come. It is in vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen cry, peace, peace. But there is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field, and we stand here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it. Almighty God, I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. It's a remarkable piece of rhetoric, isn't it? Stirring to hear it, to read it, even this day. Stirring to recall the cause, and stirring to imagine the application of those words to our own time. Well, one of the things that has puzzled me over the years is how quickly we will study the founding fathers and read what they wrote, and how seldomly we read who the founding fathers read in order to write what they wrote. If you study this little piece of this rhetorical marvel, you will quickly come to realize that Patrick Henry was not innovating a work of imaginative rhetoric. He was drawing on a vast, vast legacy inherent in this speech are a series of tropes, some from the book of Isaiah, which are readily recognizable, some from the book of Psalms, whole phrases and familiar sayings taken out of the histories of Thucydides and Herodotus. There are allusions to Homer's work, the Iliad and the Odyssey. There are bits and pieces that come directly out of the current and most popular translation of Beowulf. There are allusions to long-fought histories of battles and struggles between England and Scotland, all woven into this tiny little piece of rhetorical wonder. We hear it and we think, wow, what a man Patrick Henry was. But if we knew what it was that we were reading, we would actually say, wow, what a marvel. The education, the culture, the sense of integration, the facility with all of these various and sundry traditions from classical antiquity to the scriptures to contemporary histories, the ability to connect all of the dots, weave it all together into a coherent narrative that meant something to the cause at that moment and stirred men to rise from their seats and ultimately rise from their slumber to take up the cause of liberty. Stuff like this doesn't just happen. Patrick Henry was taught to think in a particular way. He was given the tools with which to think. He drew from this rich treasure house of rhetoric long before he ever dreamed of standing and stating his case in the Parsons Revolt or later still in the environs of St. John's Parish there in Richmond, Virginia. The fact is that Patrick Henry should not be the subject of our study, but the world, the form of education, the way of thinking, the regimen of reading that shaped him should be the subject of our study. That, in a sense, is what we attempt to do and attempt to formulate when we create an integrated humanities curriculum. I don't know if you've ever read one of Paul Johnson's histories. He's one of the great exemplars of an integrated humanities approach working in modern history today. If you've read Modern Times or The Birth of the Modern or perhaps his magisterial, The History of Art, you're struck by how it seems he's able to change subjects without you even noticing. One moment, he's talking about battlefield communications strategies just prior to the Battle of Waterloo. then you're thoroughly enmeshed in the Marshall theories of the 18th century and all of the communications breakdowns that occurred because of the centralization of authority in the Napoleonic armies, whereas with the Allies, there was a decentralization that ultimately manifested itself in broken lines of supply and broken lines of communication being able to be patched through end runs and flanking maneuvers. And there you are reading about this sort of technical 18th century Tom Clancy-like detail, and suddenly the next thing you know, the discussion shifts to the kind of flatware the troops had in their knapsacks. And the entire industry that had grown up in the creation of mass-produced flatware for armies and how that was derived from Josiah Wedgwood's pioneering work in creating beautiful and yet mass-produced pottery for the table, which then trips you into this long soliloquy on the character and nature of the Romantic movement as applied to the industrial arts. And suddenly you're miles away from Waterloo, and you've just covered about 15 different subjects, all in a kind of breathless prose that you don't even notice until all of a sudden you think, who'd have thunk that? That's the integrated humanities. It's taking a look at culture and following the footnote trail wherever it leads you. It's recognizing that sometimes the rabbit trail is the point, that sometimes being diverted off the beaten path is ultimately where you're going to get the greatest insights. If you study, for instance, the iconographic representations of the French Revolution, you're going to understand far more about the nature of revolutionary ideas, whether it's Babeuf's or Robespierre's, than you ever would if you attempted to read Babeuf or, God forbid, Robespierre, or even worse, Rousseau. The same thing goes when you're studying the revolutionary ideologies of the late 19th century. If you really want to understand Karl Marx, oh, sure, you should probably be somewhat familiar, at least with the Communist Manifesto and the 14 points that are outlined, not 10, in the Communist Manifesto. And you should probably be somewhat aware of the overall profile of the argument, at least in Volume 1 of Das Kapital. God forbid that you should ever get to Volume 3, unless, of course, you're writing some boring dissertation on Das Kapital, in which case I guess you've got to read Volume 3 in German, at which point the verb does appear by the end of Volume 3. But the fact is that there are a whole host of other ways that you can begin to understand the implications of Marxism and how Engels was able to shape the prose of Marx other than simply the study of Marx or Marxian ideology or the correlation between the First and the Second International. See, the fact is that there are all kinds of things that are happening in art and music and literature and ideas, and ultimately these things shape the culture as much, as thoroughly as the march of armies or the propagation of ideologies. The integrated humanities enables you to tie all of those loose ends together and study those pieces as a whole. Begin to see the relationships between all of these things, thus bringing them to life. Now, when your science classes are wrestling in the same time frame that your literature and history classes are, you see all of these connecting points that will give life to an understanding of a culture. That's why I oftentimes will draw attention to the integrated humanities as essentially the pan-Sophic collegium, the moral philosophy that drives classical Christian education, that can make it all come to life and ultimately seed itself into students so that we are not falling into the trap that Dorothy Sayers talked about of simply studying subjects, but actually beginning to gain knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, exercising discernment as we look at the world around us. I define humanities, and you've got this in your notes, humanities is the foundation upon which our commitment to excellent education is built. It's a study of world culture in various time periods, emphasizing the basic classical scholastic approach of moral philosophy. It's not until 1976 that history departments were called history departments. 1876. It was not until 1876 that they were called history departments. Prior to that, at the university level, the department that studied the flow of human events was called the moral philosophy department. This equips students with the tools for a lifetime of learning. A working knowledge of the timetables of history, a background understanding of the great literary classics, a familiarity with the sweep of art, music, and ideas, a worldview comprehension of basic geography, a principal approach to discerning the significance of current events, and an emphasis on a Christian life paradigm. The idea here is to study human achievement in context, both in terms of its historical and societal sequence, and in terms of its providential and cultural importance. It is out of this integrated understanding of God's world that every other subject and discipline is informed, and a theology of wonder and delight emerges. I don't know about you, but it's when I make connections between things that I have my greatest aha moments. When all of a sudden I'm able to say, okay, I understand now why it was that Charles did not bring the full weight of the Habsburg Empire against one recalcitrant Augustinian monk named Martin Luther. It was because he was being hemmed in by the assaults of Suleiman the Magnificent over on the east, and he had his attentions turned away. Not only that, but his vast designs on hegemony across the whole of the world had scattered his resources in the Americas as his conquistadors were marching across the mountains of Peru and plunging deep into the jungles of Mexico. And so it was that in God's providence at this time, the scattered Habsburg resources left little Martin Luther and his recalcitrant movement alone to begin to flower and flourish. It's when you make those connections and you say, okay, so God used the assault of the Muslims in the 1520s and 30s on the eastern edge of Christendom and the exploration of the Americas to preserve the ideas of Luther and then Zwingli and Calvin and Bucer and Cranmer, that all of a sudden the tables of history are turned, and it's because of this peculiar outworking of all of these events together. In those moments, you go, oh, I see it, I get it. And then I take the lessons from those, apply them to my own time, and all of a sudden I'm drawing these deep and profound principles and picking up the ancillary illustrations and anecdotes throughout the whole of history. And now I'm beginning to be able to exercise discernment, be able to get to the root of things, begin to understand what the nature of Romanticism is, and what it is reacting to, and how Goethe and Schiller's ideas ultimately take form in Wordsworth and Coleridge and Keats and Byron and Shelley, and why it was that Coleridge in his old age wised up and became a kind of conservative Anglican, and the others died in despair, and we begin to make these connections, and we see how it all makes sense. And ultimately, what we are driving at with our students is not a proficiency in reciting particular facts and figures, dates and dead people. Because the fact is that the details of these dates and dead people will ultimately fuzz out of remembrance for most of our students. But it is the discipline of learning how to think that will ultimately enable your students, yourselves, to attain to wisdom. Wisdom, of course, according to the Bible, is a combination of both fearing God, which is exhorted throughout the whole of the Scriptures, and knowing man, knowing what it is that man's frame is. And there's no better way to come to a fearsome understanding of the great and marvelous deeds of the Lord God Almighty than following the connections of cultures and histories and all of their permutations. And there is no better way to understand the folly of man, the repetition of his errors, than to do this as well. Ultimately, that becomes the ground for a student to then begin to make wise decisions and to do well. In the process, they learn how to love these things. It's inevitable that when you set before students a story of redemption, you tell them all about the failures and foibles of a Richard the Lionheart, and yet his ultimate redemptive purpose and the outworkings of this and all of the details that surround it, it's inevitable that kids are going to fall in love with him. Guys want to be Richard Lionheart. And when you take them on their senior trip and you're standing there in front of the Houses of Parliament and you say, "Who's that statue of right over there?" And the half a dozen of them go, "That's Richard the Lionheart!" Click, 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 click. You realize, okay, we're making connections here, and what is happening is that these students are beginning to love. They love the truths of Scripture as they are applied in the midst of this poor fallen world. They're beginning to see the marvel of creation, its intricacies, and they are comprehending God's providence as it is worked out in the enforcement of his standards in the wider world. The only way that this can be grasped is not in dusty old lectures about this narrow discipline or that narrow discipline. It's when the whole of life and experience, the record of human events, the destinies of men and nations are unfolded in a lively and imaginative way before your students. That's what an integrated humanities course is. Sometimes the course that I teach is described by students as a history class. And to some degree it is. Follow a kind of a chronology over the course of 4 years. I start at Genesis 1:1, and I generally end up where most history ends these days, with, well, today. And along the way, survey the host of the civilizations of antiquity, the birth of Christendom, the rise of various ideological movements, the peculiarities of American providence. And over the course of 4 years, we survey the whole shooting match. But along the way, I'm constantly doing a little bit of philosophy and talking about architecture. And inevitably, we talk about food and land and the metamagical themas of mathematics and science, and We talk about the heroes and the villains. We talk about the rise of movements, and we point out that that the great movements of history are never led by generals or armies. And along the way, the students begin to grasp a lot more than just history. They're reading the literature of the time, or they're reading literature about the time, not just history books, but the actual books, the primary source books, what Charlotte Mason called the living books. Along the way, they're also practicing some of the arts. We don't just study heraldry. We have the students make their own heraldic devices and do a study of their own family history, come up with new heraldic crests and all of the rest. We have had frightening moments where catapults were built and watermelons tossed and toga parties and all of the rest. And all of this in the integrated humanities, bringing the arts, the sciences, the mathematics, and all of the rest together, brings the student to the place where they really can begin to have both wisdom and delight. It was John Buchan who said, "Our greatest inheritance, the very foundation of our civilization, is a marvel to behold and consider. If I tried to describe its rich legacy with utmost brevity, I should take the Latin word humanitas. It represents, in the widest sense, the accumulated harvest of the ages, the fine flower of a long discipline of Christian thought. It is the Western mind of which we ought to turn our attentions to careful study." Now, when we started Franklin Classical School, we started at the very beginning with this notion that over the course of the 4 years of high school, a student would work their way through this sort of four-year cycle. And they might pick it up right in the middle of the cycle as a freshman, but make their way back to the end of it by the time they were a senior. And we did it in such a way that there would be a kind of modeling of the principles of the material that we were studying in the kinds of assignments that we made, the books that we read, etc., with the conscious effort to make it all, not artificially, but make it all fit together as naturally as we possibly could. What we have found is that this approach, this humanitas approach, causes students to fall in love, despite themselves, with the material. And years later, disciplines that we enforced upon them, things like daily journaling, they will come back sheepishly after college and say, I really hated that every single stupid week when we were in high school, but what I found is I'm still doing it. And it's changed the way I think and how I am and how I process what's true. And now I'm the guy in the back of the church taking notes in every sermon and coming up with which tropes work and which don't. And it's changed me forever. Thank you. I believe that we have the opportunity to recover something that is quite marvelous. You ever watch with wonder the film Shadowlands, Anthony Hopkins playing C.S. Lewis? Those moments in the film that are most intriguing to me are the moments when C.S. Lewis is sitting in his rooms with his students, and they're just talking. They've had reading assignments. They've been off to various lectures. They've had some writing assignments, but it's quite evident that the real learning takes place as they talk about anything, everything, in the context of anything and everything. That is the picture of intellectual and spiritual discipleship that is the basis of true education and that gave flower to Western civilization's great blooming of opportunity and freedom, of wisdom and delight. Now, having given that kind of ardent of sort of introduction, let's talk about details. If you have questions about how to actually begin the process of integration in your classroom or in your school, let's talk about that. Or adhering to this principle that I've just articulated, if you've got a question about anything else, Obama's Indonesian upbringing, whatever, we'll just talk about it. Yes. Yeah, great question. The question is, this all sounds wonderful, but where do you find somebody who can do it? And what a body of knowledge does a person have to have? And or what kind of personality do you have to have in order to actually pull this off? And what I would say, first of all, is that this is caught and not taught, first of all. Second of all, it is a process, an ongoing process, and you don't ever actually arrive. And therefore, it's okay to sort of poke around and find your way. The reality is that in classical Christian education, the one-eyed man is king because everybody else is just blind. And so it actually, oh, she got it. The fact is that what you really need are people who just want it really bad, who catch a glimpse of it and then set out fumbling along, finding their way. As we fumble along, we're gonna rely on old tools, reliable tools, easy to understand lesson plans and so forth. That's okay. What I would say is just begin to encourage in the culture of the school a spirit of adventure. It will lead to some disastrous moments, lesson plans that just fail utterly, fall absolutely flat. That's a part of it. That's okay. Because again, this is very much intended to be a process of discipling. It's conversation between generations. It's the one-eyed man in the land of the blind saying, "Oh, you should see this." Other questions? There are great examples of this kind of model. Almost all moral philosophies in the 18th and 19th century, you can find reprinted versions of these, took this kind of integrated approach. Yes, way back in the back. That's a great question. How do you integrate the humanities, especially if you're going through this sort of historical cycle, and you're not necessarily, as you're teaching biology, you may be in the antiquity year, you may be in the Christendom year. How do you integrate that? Well, first of all, when you're teaching a course in the sciences, there is a scope and sequence that you need to adhere to. That is a given. There is mastery of certain kinds of material that you simply have to have regardless. But how you illustrate that scope and sequence, what individuals you talk about in terms of the pioneers, the people who make discoveries, the scientists, the mathematicians, the philosophers, the standout moments can be drawn from any of those ages in history. It's the connecting of it that makes the scope and sequence then come to life. It requires a bit of work on the part of the math or the science teacher to do the reading and to go back and to familiarize yourself with the mathematical principles of Aristotle and the stuff that that Euclid pioneered, and who was Pythagoras after all, and did he really invent posthostes? I mean, you've got to do all of that kind of stuff, but when you do, even if you only do it anecdotally or illustratively, it enlivens the whole curriculum. It makes connections for the students. They begin to see it. You know, simple timelines and cross-reference charts do wonders for students to be able to start to see the connections. Does that help? Other questions? Yes. Great question. How do you guard against extrapolation? We have a limited amount of data in some eras, and sometimes we will moralize and we'll jump to Sunday school kinds of conclusions, and that can be very dangerous, to say nothing of rather tawdry. And the answer, of course, is that that there's always going to be subjectivity in anything and everything that we teach. Rudolf Bultmann made the observation about studying the Bible that there's no such thing as presuppositionless exegesis. There's no such thing as presuppositionless anything. So one of the things that that we have to do as teachers is We have to be epistemologically conscious. We have to know what it is that we believe, why it is that we believe it, what assumptions we hold before we go into a subject. And then we have to have a level of ethics and integrity in wrestling with ideas. Sometimes myth and legend is the most reliable source material that we have about a particular subject or age. We can say that. We can study that stuff. The caveat is that we tell our students, you know, this is myth and legend, and we don't know for sure. You can watch Braveheart and appreciate that this is one line of the tradition concerning William Wallace. There are about five or six others, and oh, by the way, there's the conflation of about two generations in this part of the film and in that part of the film, but here's what we can learn from it. So the answer to your question is complicated, as complicated as it always is when you have adults with assumptions teaching other people's children with their assumptions and their parents' assumptions, all unspoken. Yes, Bob. I do that all the time. I just over communicate. Great question. What role, if any, do I see for historical fiction? I love good historical fiction. In fact, truth be told, fiction began as a form with the old lyrical ballads, which was simply a versified form of historical fiction. So historical fiction has a long, tenured, and honorable place in academia and in the world of letters. We do have to acknowledge, okay, this is fiction, though these historical details are accurately reflected. I oftentimes use the book Quo Vadis, one of my favorite books. It's historical fiction written in the 19th century in the age of ideology by Heinrich Sienkiewicz, who was a Polish nationalist. It's a story about the age of Nero and the Roman Empire and the rise of Christianity. It's a beautiful portrayal of the life of those early disciples, the mechanisms and machinery of the Roman Empire. It's very, very historically accurate in many places. But Heinrich Sienkiewicz wrote it as a kind of moral tale for an ideological age during which his people were being oppressed by a massive empire, in this case the Russians over the Polish. There were all kinds of faith implications, and Sienkiewicz is drawing all of these allusions. He's telling this story. If you read it on the surface, it's all this, oh, Jesus, oh, Paul, oh, look, Peter, oh, this is neat, and you're doing all of this Book of Acts thing, and ooh, Nero, bad Nero. The whole time, Sienkiewicz is actually talking about the Tsar, the oppressed Polish people, and he's using this this story as a parable for it all. Now, if you see all of that, know all of that, teach your students to look for all of that, then it becomes an enormously enriching enterprise, both to learn about Nero and Rome and the early life of the disciples in the era of the Acts, as well as 19th century ideology and why pagan antiquity and pagan modernity are basically the same civilization, in the same way that Fred Flintstone and George Jetson are the same person. Does that help? Yes. During when I'm teaching the American Revolution, I have the students do pamphleteering. When we're studying the advent of the commercial age, I have them create a commercial advertising campaign for some 19th century product. The age of antiquity's great mythological movements, I have them do mythological retellings, you know, C.S. Lewis, Till We Have Faces style. So we're taking both the skills from those periods and the themes, and we're weaving them together so that the student is really getting hands-on experience with those things. In addition, they have to make public presentations, and so they're learning how, from the earliest stages, how to stand in front of a crowd and talk about the work that they've done and the process of integration. So, you know, this year we did, we studied antiquity. We had everything from the building of sarcophagi, the creation of Egyptian makeup, the cooking of Greek food across the board to the building of catapults and siege works and battering rams and Lord knows what else. I think I just delineated guy-girl without even trying. Other questions? Yes. Oh, sorry. Question from the cheap seats. Yes. There are lots of places to go to. One of the things that I always recommend is read old history books before the ideological age. that they're sometimes harder to get, harder to find, but that is enormously helpful. Read the historical classics. In the modern era, there are a number of historians that do this kind of integrative work. A lot of times we'll really disagree with them. The body of work of Paul Johnson, who I mentioned at the beginning, is a helpful body of work. We can watch in Paul Johnson's progress across his publishing life, his transition from a kind of skeptic liberal to a neoconservative to a Thatcherite to a Tony Blair Laborite to a confessional Roman Catholic lamenter of all things modern. And so it's not the point of view that you're looking for. It's really his whole approach to looking at a culture and that whole integrative approach. Barbara Tuchman from the previous generation often did that. Her remarkable book about the 14th century called A Distant Mirror is very helpful because she deliberately says the 14th century and, in this case, the 20th century have so many remarkable comparisons. We would never think of that on the surface, but she surveys this one particular county in France to capture a sense of the whole of Europe at the time and simultaneously drawing connections with the modern age. And it's quite helpful. The other thing that I do is I follow favorite authors. I love G.K. Chesterton. And so it was a natural thing for me to move from his character sketches and his books like Orthodoxy and Heretics into his studies. He has a history of England. And to see his approach is enormously helpful. It's not always great history, but it's always a great intellectual exercise to help me to see history. Yes? My wife and I did a book entitled Shelf Life, which we do all kinds of historical vignettes about libraries and bookkeeping and bookish places and bookish people. And there are lists all through there and lots of quotations. We sort of imagined the book as we were pulling it together as a series of dinner table conversations at Le Brie. So it talks about food and music and all of the ways that food and music and shelves and places and travel all connect us to books.
Shelf life.
Okay.
Who
publishes that? Cumberland House. Cumberland House. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of other helpful things like that out there. There is no canonical list except of the scriptures. We have to lay careful foundations so that in those earlier stages, we do a mini version of making our way through the cycles with our junior high students. We're laying foundations of everything from geography to the timetables of history to the basic learning disciplines in those earlier grades. And there are lots of different ways to do that. The important thing is to plan ahead, knowing that you've got to lay certain foundations so that students have the tools and the vocabulary to then make that leap once they've reached the freshman year in high school. So we do a mini version of the cycle in the junior high age. We're laying the foundations earlier. Obviously, all of the basic disciplines in the grammar stage are preparing students. I mean, the reason we do grammar in the first place in all of our disciplines is so that we can build the vocabulary to move on once the knowledge or grammar stage is intact. We can start to move into the understanding stage and into the logic stage. And once we are there, then we can start to make the leap. But even once we've made the leap, most students are in free fall for at least their whole freshman year and half of their sophomore year. And oftentimes think the world has come to an end. They may have been a straight-A student all the way through the eighth grade, and all of a sudden they get Dr. Grant, and they don't know what on earth I'm talking about from day one. And then all of a sudden, somewhere along the way, say in February of their sophomore year, it's like, whoa! I know what he's talking about. My son-in-law is from Peru, and he and my daughter were watching a film the other day, and they were at home, they'd put the DVD in, they're sitting on the couch, and they're watching, and he's about three-quarters of the way through, and all of a sudden he realizes, there are no subtitles, and I understand every word. That's what happens in the sophomore year. They don't have to use Big Sister's cheat sheet anymore. They actually know what Dr. Grant's talking about. And actually, that free fall is a helpful thing to sort of get lost and realize, you know what? I'm going to actually have to think. I can't memorize the answer to this. There's no exact formula here. I'm not going to be able to just spew the stuff that I've crammed into my cranium. I'm going to have to actually use the tools to think. Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, they do. The problem with the parents is that when they free fall, they don't cry, they yell. You just have to be certain that this is what you're supposed to do. And you have to be able to say, you know what? This is what we're going to do. We've been doing it for a while here. We're going to keep doing it. And you know what? Your child is going to get it. And you're going to be the greatest advocate of this. And if not, you know what? You may actually need to go and join the pep squad over at Behemoth High. Other questions? Yes, Gary. One of the basic institutions that God establishes in creation in accordance with His providence and His word is the civil sphere. It is vital that that an understanding of civil structures is woven into the humanities. There are some particular aspects of the civitas that need to be understood by students in the dialectical stages of their development. So the answer is there's a vital role that the civitas plays in the overarching education of a thinking student. So we've got to teach them the difference between a covenantal worldview and a horizontal worldview and how that fleshes out in actual governing structures. Why is it that a nom lugal in Babylon looks exactly the same as it does in Zimbabwe? Why is it that there's not a horsehair's difference between Robert Mugabe and Nebuchadnezzar? You've got to teach that, and then what you've got to do is you've got to enable students to think through those processes, understand our own governance structure from a worldview perspective, and then be able to make practical sorts of choices and take appropriate actions therein. So our purpose is to engage them. Anybody else? And I apologize for any of you who actually teach at Behemoth High. That was not intentional. It just sort of came out. It's kind of like Robin Williams. Every so often, he just erupts with a... And there it is. Yeah, Christian Almanac is a book that Greg Wilbur and I put together, which is an attempt to go chronologically through the whole year, 2 pages for every day of the year, just describing all of the stuff and all the connections of those stuff, in fact, of those things in that stuff. One of the things that I oftentimes do, don't do this every year, but it's somewhat of a tradition, is I'll actually start every one of my lectures with stuff that happened on this day in history. And I always try and find a way to connect this stuff to internally each of these events throughout the whole range of history from the day that the Beatles made their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show all the way across the board to when Robert Burns decided to write Scott's What Hay in commemoration of the great victory at Bannockburn, tie all of that together with whatever it is that my lecture is on that day, which sometimes is a fitful thing. Yes. Well, thank you. The lectures are available. The Giles Kirk curriculum itself was distributed by a distributor who is no longer distributing it, and so we're reconfiguring the material. So the material is available. The curriculum as a curriculum is not. Yes. Well, that's great. I usually refer them to a friend of mine, Ben House's blog, and just tell them if you want, just go look at his blog and get all of your objectionable material there. No, actually, I think in the panel discussion with all of the plenary speakers a little while ago, there's a similar question that arose. The fact is that you can't tell the story of redemption without stuff that you have to be redeemed from. Geoffrey Chaucer, for instance, is very purposeful in contrasting stories that have no redemptive value and stories about exactly the same kinds of gross stuff that do have redemptive value. And the contrast between them is the contrast between that which is obscene and that which is profane. Obscene is where you portray sin clearly, but you're not looking at the details directly. It's off scene. It's from behind the curtain. Shakespeare does this all the time. Shakespeare has all kinds of sinful stuff going on. It's only in modern film adaptations that we actually have to see it. Typically, a traditional Shakespearean production is going to have all of that obscene material where it belongs, off-scene, obscene. Chaucer makes the distinction between that off-scene portrayal of sin, which is necessary for us to understand the story of redemption. It's necessary for us, Doug Wilson said in the earlier session, there's a great quote by G.K. Chesterton in which he said, books with no wicked characters are wicked books. If it's all Pollyannish, if you don't have things to wrestle with in this poor fallen world, If you don't have, you know, the contrast, there's no possible way that you can move towards some sort of redemptive ending. The question is, do you revel in the filth of the sin? Do you defile the mind of the reader or the viewer or the listener in the process? What we've got to avoid is that which is profane, that which exalts in the sin itself. And we've got to focus on the obscene. Chaucer does this, and he deliberately draws the contrast as a means. I mean, when a tale is told that is indeed profane, there will be some character who will rise up and say, as does the reeve in the reeve's tale, that's wicked and that is perverse. Let me show you how to tell that story right. That's a very helpful thing for a student. Now, we've got to be careful about it. We've got to be age-appropriate with it. You're not going to want to roll out the Epic of Gilgamesh to second graders. But you know, a student ultimately does need to know about the Epic of Gilgamesh so that they're not sitting in, you know, a college lecture hall in political science sometime and have an infidel trot out the Epic of Gilgamesh as evidence of pre-diluvian ideas about flood narratives and all of that and dash a student's faith. But I don't feel strongly about it or anything. All right, any other questions? Yes. Actually, what you can do is you can break it up into modules, and you can one of the things we know that literature is best studied in smaller groups. If you can break up into a series of modules, the humanities block, have a kind of overview lecture, and then break into age-divided literature classes, discussion classes, study sessions. What you are able to do in that way is to aim at a little bit more age appropriateness in the assignments, in, say, the journaling requirements or whatever. Also have a lot more opportunity for interaction and so forth. So you can actually break it up, and you can do all of it. Depending upon how your school day functions, you can do all of it in the same sort of structure that a history lit grammar course could you know, those three courses could be contained in. So you can do this. It's going to depend a little bit upon your personnel and space and all of that kind of stuff. But the way we do it is we have a big lecture with all of the high school together in one lecture, and then we divide up into either skill sets or class levels for the other stuff. Well, let me just close with this. This is one of my favorite quotes. It is Percy Shelley's, "The truest education is a redolent fountain, forever overflowing with the waters of wisdom and delight." That makes for a great classroom. Bless you. Remember to go downstairs, empty your pocketbooks, pick up the History of Iraq tapes, and enjoy. Hey.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, you have actually taught my children and I quite a bit.
Oh.
I didn't realize it, but this is how I've been teaching them at home.
Oh, praise God.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hi there. How are you?